Well, greetings to all, and a special shout out to the hostile invading alien armies hovering silently, hiding behind their cloaking devices in space. Remember, eat the Canadians first. They have much better health care. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. It's Sunday night, and I am suddenly flush with regret over how much I promoed tonight's show with Nicholas Meyer last night on Coast to Coast, because the more I talked up this show tonight, the more it occurred to me, the more people might be inclined to listen, the more they're going to be inclined to listen, the more they're going to hear me be struck dumb with a certain amount of concern about how I'm going to be in this interview with Nicholas Meyer, who's one of my heroes for what he has been able to write and what he has directed. I've always been curious about him since the first time I really intersected with his work, which was back with the movie Time After Time. I know that he had done 7% Solution, the Sherlock Holmes story. We'll get to that certainly in context of this new Sherlock Holmes movie that's out. But it just is one of those things where I've just always been sort of caught up with questions about him, and to be able to get a chance to interview him is a real thrill, but I'm a little starstruck, and it will show. The View from the Bridge is the name of his book, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. We'll get to it coming up in just a second. Also, should mention that there are many people who are very curious, too, about their own particular Star Trek question, at least as it pertains to Star Trek II, you know, 4 and 6. And these are the Star Trek movies that Nicholas Meyer was involved with. And so he's been very kind to give us an extra hour so that I get two with him. You get one. It should be a great show. We'll get it started next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Nicholas Meyer's book, as far as I know, the first memoir he's ever written is The View from the Bridge. Good evening, Nicholas Meyer.
Good evening.
Now, do you prefer Nicholas or Nick?
I'm Nicholas in print and anything else you like in conversation.
Well, I notice in many of the stories you talk about in the book, the people who have known you oldest still refer to you as Nicky.
Correct.
So I was surprised by that. I wouldn't have guessed that. You didn't strike me as a Nicky when I was watching these movies. And I go back, as I said, to Time After Time with you, and I love this movie. This is a movie that is still, I think, the high watermark for time travel adventure movies. And I've always had questions about it because when I saw it, not only did, you know, me and many other guys fall in love with Mary Steenburgen during that movie, because she just is so cute. Yeah, I mean, she is just so adorable, and it was so well directed. But it's just all the pieces fit together, which so never happens really with time travel movies. So that was how I first. I've always been curious about you ever since then, and that's, you know, that was a time well before the internet, and it wasn't like you were the best known director in Hollywood. I mean, you would pop up now and again, but you weren't everywhere, and so it's really cool to read your story. Thank you for sharing it.
You're entirely welcome.
Okay, and your story starts as like so many do on this show. You start as a kid with an interesting set of parents and a life where you were kind of carving it out on your own from the very beginning. Talk about your childhood a little bit before we get into the Star Trek-y stuff.
Well, I was born in New York 6 months after the end of the Second World War into a middle-class family, which was back when there was such a thing as a middle-class family, I suppose. My father was a psychoanalyst and my mother was a concert pianist. And we lived on the on Manhattan. I was born on Manhattan. I was a native, and these circumstances I now realize were extraordinarily privileged, and I was very, very lucky. New York at the time was a font of sort of cultural and intellectual diversity and plenty. And I was exposed to all this in a rather effortless way. I just got taken to see plays and ballets and the opera. And, when television came along, we finally got one. But otherwise, it was the movies. And it was a sort of hothouse atmosphere of things to do and read and see. And I sort of fell in love with everything that got thrown at me and didn't realize, I think, until later, you know, how lucky I was to have been born in those circumstances at that time. My parents were rather, I guess they were sort of spectacular people, and I was intimidated by them, but I was also fascinated. And when I wrote my autobiographical novel, not to be confused with my memoir, I described them as circus acrobats working without a net.
Right. And I think as it was a middle class existence on, you know, in the way in which you experienced it in some respects, they also traveled in sort of non middle class circles. I mean, they had, because of your father's job and your mother's abilities, you know, they had an interesting circle of friends on which, you know, you grew up on a few famous people's knees.
They were famous, but they were not necessarily wealthy or well-to-do. My father's sister was married to a Professor Harold Chernus of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He was a Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit scholar, and we would go to Princeton for Thanksgiving. And it is true that at these Thanksgiving dinners, one might encounter J. Robert Oppenheimer or Albert Einstein. They were there. And when I was seven, I sat next to Einstein, and I said, "I have a hair in my turkey." And he said, "Not so loud. Everyone else will want one."
It's a great vaudeville
line. I have no recollection of this, by the way, but it has entered family lore.
Well, it helps to form you, and it and hearing those stories about, you know, those types of legendary people, of course, now that kind of comes back up again, it would seem like, in your work. Because, I mean, to be exposed to somebody like an Oppenheimer or an Einstein, no big surprise later on that you would do movies that feature, you know, people like H.G. Wells, you know, Sherlock Holmes, or Sigmund Freud. I mean, it sort of follows the pattern a little bit that you kind of like get exposed to that. And the idea of these people just sort of casually being characters in your life, and I think it seems like anyway, would pop up in your work.
Well, I think what happened to me at a fairly early age was I became an insatiable reader. I just consumed books. I'm not a very fast reader, I should say. In fact, quite the opposite. But there was something about the world in which I found myself where sometimes I think as a means of self-protection or just sort of finding some downtime or being by myself, I could read The Three Musketeers, or I could read Sherlock Holmes, or I could read The Hardy Boys. It didn't really matter. I was very Catholic in my taste. That just went all over the map. But I didn't, you know, read a whole bunch of stuff. And I was also a music fool, and I loved reading the backs of record jackets. That's something I really miss, is you can't read the backs of record jackets anymore.
Right.
Because there's no records.
Yeah, and there's something to me, and maybe this is just, again, how I'm sort of, you know, sifting through your life, but there's something to me that I thought that was indicative of your later adventures on the screen, is that you were willing to set off for the what would have been, you know, the undiscovered country of Iowa to go to college, which would have been, I would think, unusual amongst your peer group to go to some place like Iowa City.
Well, there was
at a big time school.
That is absolutely true. It is also true that I was not a particularly distinguished student. There was no way I was going to follow my father's footsteps and wind up at Harvard, for example. I had what was later, years later, diagnosed as ADD, which made issues of focus, concentration, organization very difficult for me. And unless it was something that interested me. If it was something that interested me, I could stay with it for hour after hour after hour. But it really impeded a normal course of academic study. And my college advisor at school in New York said, "Well, you're very passionate about film and literature, and maybe what you ought to do is go to the writer's workshop." And I said, "Where is that?" And he said, "Iowa City, Iowa." And it was a very unusual thing for me to hear. But yeah, I've since figured out that the world of American letters is largely dominated by either those who taught or those who studied at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa.
Right.
So, and I went there and got to sort of start my life over, and it was, Iowa City was in some ways the first time in my life I was really happy, and I did very well there.
I love Iowa City. I've been there many times. It is. It's a really fun town, and I had a friend of mine's grandmother lived behind the VA hospital right on the campus.
Oh, you're kidding. I know exactly where that is.
Well, you know where that big, there's a big hill that's right by the VA hospital. There's this big, for whatever reason, there's this big sort of hilly area back, and we always used to go over there, and we put our car in neutral and just let it coast down the hill and up the other side, which passes for big fun in Iowa City.
Oh, that was you.
Yeah, so that was a good time. Would have been actually right about the same time that you were going to college there.
My dad, who was a very insular and somewhat parochial New Yorker, believed that Iowa was, you know, that everything in the middle of the country was completely flat. But after he'd huffed and puffed up a few hills in Iowa City, he had to change his tune.
Well, it wasn't a big surprise that you should go there, but except that, you know, there was a few schools between New York and Iowa City that you could have gone to, and that after you graduated, that you got into writing, and then I liked how you described it, as you were going to drive out west, as you had an opportunity to kind of, you know, take this writing business, a titch up, and get into show business a little bit more. And I talk a little bit about what your father's reaction was to you going down that road, as opposed to something more of a profession, a doctor, lawyer kind of a thing.
Well, I think my father, who was nothing if not an extremely perspicacious guy, figured out fairly early on that I was an artist or I was nothing. And that was a aspect of me, a plant that he watered, if you like. He figured out that this is what spoke to me and this is what I had some aptitude for. And whatever his own feelings about whether I was or was not ever likely or destined to follow in his footsteps was somewhat, I think, offset by his seeing how keen I was on literature, on film. Also the fact that I think my father was a little bit of an artist manqué himself. He wrote two full-length biographies, one of Houdini and one of Joseph Conrad. He wrote a lot of short stories, and I think that in some respects later on, particularly when I did achieve some success, I think he had a lot of second thoughts, wondering if maybe he shouldn't have gone down this path himself. I think it aroused a lot of feelings of ambivalence in him. He was very proud of me, but later on in his life, I think he had sort of a lot of second guessing of paths not taken.
Well, he had nothing to be ashamed of. Obviously, he had done quite well.
He was not ashamed.
Right.
It was more, it wasn't the question of shame. It was
right.
Just questioning what would have happened.
Sure.
If he had tried his hand at it earlier. He was an excellent pianist. He could sight read any piece of music you put in front of him. And he had a sort of artistic temperament. So when he realized, I think way before I realized it, that this was what I was destined for, as I say, he nurtured this a lot. He cultivated that aspect of my personality by throwing books and music and films at me as fast as I could gobble them up.
I experienced some of that to a degree with, I have an 18-year-old son who is a champion swimmer. You wouldn't look at me and think I produce a champion swimmer. Huh. And occasionally I look at him in the pool and I think, well, what if I had been a swimmer? And I realized
exactly.
It wouldn't have gone very far. So I don't know how he did it. And he came from my loins, but I'm not exactly sure how. But
live and learn.
Yeah. So let's I'll leave up to the book, The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, to fill in some of the blanks between where we leave that off and where Nicholas Meyer's career begins really as a successful screenwriter. And I will add, one of my few disappointments for tonight's show is, although I had ordered it and paid extra to have it shipped to me on time, Invasion of the Bee Girls never arrived.
Well,
and I wanted to watch
that. You in the same place as I, because I have never seen the movie.
Which was your first big successful screenplay.
I suppose.
It was. It got made, dude.
Yes,
not many people.
It did get made, that is for sure.
Even if it wasn't made the way you had originally intended, or they sucked out 20% of the cleverness to get it done, it was still, and the fact that it's still available on DVD is remarkable in its own right.
I didn't even know it was.
Yep. And on Amazon, it was, I haven't gotten it yet, so I'm assuming that it still was. But it was something like $8, and it came packaged with another horror type movie of its era. So you got it as a twofer on a DVD with another movie.
The bottom half of a double bill, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it's really hard to get a copy of 7% Solution on DVD. It's out of print or something.
I keep trying to get Universal Pictures to do a proper DVD of it, and so far no one ever listens.
Well, I was trying to buy it on Amazon, and it was up to $250 to get a copy of it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, or eBay too, for that matter. It was very expensive. So there you go. So a screenwriter, and then comes a screenwriter strike, and that's when you decide, since you can't write for TV, you can't write for film, that you knock out the novel 7% Solution. And again, I think that's kind of cool that Sir Sigmund Freud hooked up with Sherlock Holmes, and in a way that pulls upon that background that you had with your father. I think that's kind of, that was cool to utilize that right away in Hollywood.
Well, the origin of that book was that people used to say to me, oh, your old man's a shrink. Is he a Freudian? And I didn't know the answer. How would I? So I said to him one day, Papa, are you a Freudian? And he said, well, it's a silly question. And I said, why is it a silly question? And he said, well, it's because it's no more possible to discuss the history of psychoanalysis without starting with Freud than it is to discuss the history of America without starting with, you know, Columbus or the Vikings, if you want to get cute. But to suppose that nothing has happened since the Vikings is
right,
to be pretty rigid, pretty doctrinaire. So he said, when a patient comes to see me, I listen to what they say. I listen to how they say it. I'm particularly interested in what they don't say. I look at how they are dressed. I look at whether they're on time. I look at their body language. In short, I am searching for clues from them as to why they are not happy. And I thought, oh, my God, now I know who my dad always reminded me of, Sherlock Holmes. And I said, you know, what you do sounds like detective work. And he said, very much like detective work. And then I started wondering how much Sherlock Holmes' creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, knew about the life and writing of Sigmund Freud. And the first thing I realize is, okay, they're both doctors. Oh, and they both were living in London. And they died 9 years apart. Doyle studied ophthalmology in Vienna. And Freud's first use of cocaine involved a paper written with two eye doctors about the use of cocaine as an anesthetic during eye surgery. So these coincidences started to pile up, and the end result was my Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud novel, The 7% Solution.
You realize that's the dream. I mean, that's where every screenwriter in Hollywood would read this book, and they would think, this is what I wanted of my life. Whether they were successful or not successful, the idea that when you tried something, by and large, it worked, whether it was television movies, whether it was, if there was a writer strike, you end up writing a best-selling novel, the third best-selling book of that year, and then turning that into a screenplay, that's Goldfinger territory. That's Midas territory. You're able to turn things around, and that's part of the story of The View from the Bridge. And that golden touch is definitely what saves Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. We'll get into that coming up a little bit later on. The story of Nicholas Meyer is told, The View from the Bridge, continues. And we're just getting to Time After Time, where we started earlier this half hour, the classic time travel movie, which Steven Spielberg himself watched over and over again as they were creating Back to the Future. More on that coming up next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, Nicholas Meyer. We'll talk about Time After Time. That song is not from the movie, but it always reminds me of the movie. And if you haven't seen it, you should. Time After Time is fun. And it was smart. And Tab A fit into slot B in this movie in ways which often they don't in time travel films, where really there are a lot of loose ends where you go, but wait, what if, you know, and it all kind of came together nicely. We'll talk about time travel in film, and we'll talk about science fiction coming up next with Nicholas Meyer on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, before Nicholas Meyer had a chance to fix and then direct the sequel to the original Star Trek movie, Wrath of Khan, of course, which is the movie by which most people know Nicholas Meyer out of the box. If you had to ask them, they would say, "Oh, I know that movie." He did Time After Time, and I, you know, you do the thing which everybody hopes they're able to do, which is parlay one success into another. The successful best-selling novel 7% Solution gets turned into a successful screenplay, and you start learning, you get a chance to work with a really good director on 7% Solution, learning enough from that to be able to direct on your own. That's pretty cool. I mean, to be able to do that, that's something which a lot of people dream that they're able to do in Hollywood and can't.
Well, there are two important parts to that story, or to my story, and one is I've been very, very lucky. And luck cannot be sort of underestimated. Somebody once recommended a general to Napoleon and said he was a very, very good general. And Napoleon said, yes, but is he lucky? And the second part is that I think that you hear all kinds of horror stories about Hollywood, Los Angeles, and the movie business, and I'm sure they're all true. But it's also true that this business is filled with some pretty wonderful and generous and loyal people. And so between my luck and the people that I met, I was extremely fortunate in finding people to sponsor me, to support me, to trust me and say, hey, I realize you've never directed a feature film in your life, but we're going to let you direct this one.
Yeah, but that's not luck. And I would argue with you, and I would say you made your own luck. And even reading your story, the bold moves that you would make in just deciding to pick up the phone and see whether or not your favorite author would take your call, or when you would challenge, you know, even early on, you would challenge in the publishing process, you did things which other people would say were foolish or pointless, and you did them, and you created your own luck. You packed up your manuscript for 7% Solution, you took it to New York, and you started pounding on doors with the only guy that you knew that was in publishing. That's not luck. That's not luck in the same sense that I would think of as, you know, somebody that just happens to buy a lottery ticket standing on a street corner and later on wins.
Well, perhaps it's not the same as that. And I don't mean to discount or, you know, which I sometimes, maybe I do it, whatever abilities that I possess. But I think there are talented people, maybe more talented people, who don't have the kind of luck or whatever it is that makes you get on the plane with the book and take it someplace and start banging on the door.
But is that luck or is that chutzpah? I mean,
well, it's
just
a little bit of both, I think.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, I mean, but I think what you create circumstances where people, you create your own jet stream. And by doing that, you kind of suck people into your, you know, into that tailwind of yours.
Well, I think that suckered a few of them, yeah.
But I mean, I think that's where I hear people talk about luck, and I, you know, I've been a little bit around this business in one way or another, and I see people that are willing to take chances and humiliate themselves. And I see people that wait for the world of entertainment or that next big thing to come to them. And I think you're one of those people who decided, well, all they can do is hang up. All they can do is call me an idiot. All they can do is do these things, which they end up not doing. And by not doing so, you end up creating friends in the business that are rooting for you, that are pulling for you.
Well, there's no question. I've been, I don't want to set you off with the word luck, but
I'm going to go crazy.
A lot of very nice people, a lot of very generous people, a lot of very sort of trusting people. And there is something to be said for being willing to make a fool of yourself. I think that's part of what being any kind of artist is that willingness to assume a sort of childlike, not necessarily childish, but sort of childlike openness to, you know, what the possibilities are, and sort of stepping off the plank and holding your nose and hoping you're going to land in a damp sponge, and sometimes you do. But I think the name of the game of being an artist anyway, the things you learn from Woody Allen or Philip Roth or any of the greats that you think of, is coming up to bat, showing up, being there, swinging for the fences. And it's sometimes, you know, it's a little bit like asking a girl out on a date. You know, what's the worst that could happen? She's going to say no, or she's going to laugh and say no. But you don't, as Lear says, nothing will come of nothing.
Right. You got to, if you don't, you ask, it seems like in your career, especially in the early part of your career, but maybe it's the theme throughout your career after reading the book, is that you ask, why can't I? Why can't I do this? And in going from the successful screenplay and then the successful movie, 7% Solution, into Time After Time, you said, why can't I direct this? Why can't I? And you kind of put it on the other person to tell you no. I mean, you say you want to. You attach yourself to the screenplay. You say you want the screenplay. You want me. Inside, a lot of people would be filled with such self-doubt that they would never have that opportunity to find the luck of a hit movie.
Well, I did this sort of leapfrog method, which I sold the 7% Solution to the movies on condition that I write the script. And later I sold the script for Time After Time to the movies on condition that I direct it. I was certainly filled with all kinds of self-doubt, which I did not trouble to communicate to anybody.
Right.
But at the moment when Warner Brothers turned around and said, okay, you can direct the movie, you know, you better believe that, you know, that everything started to loosen up in my intestines. And I thought, gosh, what
I get myself into? Right.
You know, buyer's remorse. But I also think that one of the things that's good, and I've seen countless articles about this, even lately, the New York Times had an article about, you know, people in their 80s and 90s trying new things. One guy was wing walking, and I thought, well, I don't know if I'll be up for wing walking when I'm 89, but I had to take my hat off to him for just saying, if you want to sort of not just be taking up space or not just be going through the motions, then challenge yourself. Try something new. Try something different. Be willing to fail. Being willing to fail is very freeing. Because, you know, once you're sort of reconciled to that possibility, oh, yes, I may go down in flames here, then in a way you got nothing to lose.
Well, you say going down in flames. There's a reason why the motto of the 366th Fighter Wing Division was the same motto as the in ancient Rome, is fortune favors the bold. And you got to be willing to go down in flames if you're going to ever achieve anything. And you, that's what you did by saying, I'm going to direct Time After Time. Talk about time travel. In one sense, I find that very, I thought what you did everything right. I know you didn't write the original story for Time After Time, but talking about, here's H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper going back into modern day, would have been modern day 1979. And they this sort of, you know, battle of wits between these two historical figures, so to speak. But you were able to make that story work. You were able to make the pieces fit, which, no big surprise, Spielberg used your success of that as a model, it would seem, for Back to the Future. What about time travel interested you, and why do time travel movies often fail?
Well, in the first place, I'm not sure that time travel per se interests me a lot. What interests me most is stories or good stories. I never really cared whether it was a funny story or a sad story or a story set in the future or the present or the past. None of that really made much of a dent on me, as so long as it was a good story. And somebody said, well, what's your definition of a good story? And I said, well, I guess my definition is a story that once you've heard it, you understand why I wanted to tell it to you. That's my definition of a good story, a story that justifies its own existence. And I knew a man that was at Iowa when I was there, a playwright named Carl Alexander. And Carl, subsequent to the publication and success of The 7% Solution, got hold of me, and he said, listen, I'm writing a novel that is sort of inspired by The 7% Solution, and I have 65 pages in an outline. Would you read it and give me a critique? And I had a lot more time on my hands back then, and I said, sure. So I read his novel, and I gave a critique of it and handed it back to him, and then I couldn't sleep for 3 months because I thought, oh, my God, what a great idea he's got hold of here, and what a great movie it would make. But the truth is, Meyer, you never would have thought of this in a trillion years, which is true. Most of my ideas are not terribly interesting. But I am a very good recognizer of ideas when they stop right in front of me and sit in the middle of the road. But it did take me 3 months to wake up and say, well, if you like the thing so much, why don't you option those 65 pages, which is exactly what I did. Called him up and said, hey, can I option your unfinished novel? And then I sort of wrote it the way I wanted to write it, as a screenplay. And, felt terribly pleased with myself and thought, this isn't really going to be a very expensive movie because it's just two guys in Victorian outfits running around in a contemporary world. I won't even have to do props, but everything is going to look like sci-fi hardware. It's all going to be eye candy to an audience that will look at themselves for the first time from the point of view of an alien, which is to say somebody from another time. And that was the genesis of Time After Time, and the rest of it, as you say, was putting slot, B and getting tab A to fit it. And I had a lot of fun doing that. Now, I'm not a Jack the Ripper buff. He was small potatoes anyway, compared to everybody who's come afterwards. But these people as sort of symbols, in the 7% Solution, they're very much individuals. Holmes is a very specific person. Freud is a very specific person. In Time After Time, it seems to me that H.G. Wells represents the sort of positive, progressive side of humanity, and the Ripper is its dark, malignant, destructive counterpart. And that's what was fun about having them face off.
Well, but in Social Commentary, it was interesting to see H.G. Wells face a future which he was, which was counterintuitive to what he thought the future would be. Utopian, we would be getting better. Everything about the future from H.G. Wells' perspective as a Victorian was going to be about sort of purifying with every generation.
A socialist utopia.
Right. And then and here's Jack the Ripper, who in one of the memorable lines for me in the movie talks about the fact that this is his time. He's in his element.
He turns on the television for Wells in a hotel room and flips through the channels and says, 90 years ago, I was a freak. Today, I'm an amateur.
Right. You know what interested me about that was actually one of the first times I was curious about you. Was as a as the auteur of the of what I was watching. I was in college when I was watching the movie Time After Time. Actually, I was in college with my favorite English professor, who came from the Writers' Workshop. I was watching that movie, and I was interested in two things that I saw thematically, which you had done, which I And, you know, stop me if I'm way off base here. So, you know, these are one of these embarrassing moments that where I could bring this up and you go, really? I had no intention of doing that.
But if I may interrupt you for one second.
Sure.
Artists are not the answers to a series of math equations at the back of the book. Artists lose all proprietary control over what they've created when it's done, when it's finished, when it's out there. There's no way I can say that whatever you've made of something that I've written or filmed is wrong. My opinion is just another opinion.
Oh, no, I get that. I remember that part in your book. I'm emboldened by that myself to
so
be able to
take your best shot.
I was very curious about, well, not very curious about, I just thought it was interesting that in the time travel sequence, I detected this very sort of pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian position of you, the director, which didn't bother me, but I just thought it was interesting. And then it comes up again in that scene where he's flipping around the TV. And it was just a piece of information about you that I thought, oh, that's so interesting that kind of jumped off the screen for me. Was that just a coincidence?
No, it's not a coincidence, but I think, you know, it was sort of where my head was at the time. I didn't really quite understand what, you know, the Palestinian people were on about in a way that I think I much better understand then. I think I was sort of an unquestioning supporter of Israel for a very long time. And now I find myself, as they sort of keep expanding into the West Bank, very, very sort of disillusioned, and movies are sort of snapshots, or all art is really a snapshot of the moment at the time in which it was created, whether it's a painting, a novel, a movie. And at that point, that was sort of how I thought the world worked. And, you know, later on, I found myself wondering, really, they can't settle up here? Were they really right after the 67 war to hang on to the West Bank? Was that a smart move? And I became sort of disillusioned because I saw sort of apartheid existence being carved out, which was ironic given what had happened to Jews in the Second World War and before.
Yeah, and I saw the same echo of that in Star Trek VI in the time travel sequence back into time Star Trek IV. Sorry. I saw that same thing. And I was like, oh, Nicholas, that seemed like a fingerprint of Nicholas Meyer.
I don't know. I can't remember what happens in four that.
It's just it's another marker when they're going back. You have these little sort of historical, these sort of headlines in time kind of a thing, or it seemed like it anyway. I could be wrong on that, but it was interesting to me that I felt like I was getting a glimpse of who you were. And for whatever reason, that stayed with me in time after time. And I really liked the movie. And I was an evangelist for the movie. I was walking around telling people, oh, you got to see this movie. And it was no surprise to me that the movie did as well as it did. My only surprise is that it isn't remembered better and that it isn't often spoken of as really being sort of the template for all time travel movies.
Well, if I have anything to say about it, or if my mother has anything to say about it, she'll tell you.
Yeah. And so, again, just as you've taken one thing and then parlayed it into another, you took the success of that eventually into Wrath of Khan. But for a while there, and this is, again, as somebody who is a fan of yours after time, I'm looking up going, where'd that guy go? Where was Nicholas Meyer? I thought, oh, what a great movie. How come he hasn't done another movie? And then the highest compliment I can pay to you, when Star Trek II came up, and I, you know, obviously this is pre-internet, and I wasn't reading a lot of, Hollywood magazines or anything, your name flashed up on the screen. And I remember turning to my friend that was sitting next to me, and I said, oh, Nicholas Meyer, this is going to be good.
Thank you.
It's true. And it was, and it's fascinating. So we'll pick up with Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. We'll start there. Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, Nicholas Meyer. The View from the Bridge is the new book out. You can link up to it through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. Khan! Next on Coast to Coast.